With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial, and with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown, and through adaptable problem-solving, we do just that. Learn more at marines.com.
I think the greater risk to self-government, government of the people, by the people, for the people, is the fact that our politicians, some of them anyway, don't really believe or seem to believe in that notion that elections are to be held for the sake of the voters, right? Democracy belongs to the people as a whole. We don't hold elections for the sake of the politicians, right? The people are supposed to decide.
Hello and welcome to Why Is This Happening with me, your host, Chris Hayes. We are, as I speak to you now, less than 4 weeks until the election. People are already voting in many states. In fact, early voting is already breaking early records. We expected that because there's two things happening. One, the pandemic means that way more people are going to vote in sort of alternative means. Absentee, mail-in voting, and early in-person or some combination of the two, where people get their absentee ballots early and they drop them off at drop boxes. So we always knew that because of the pandemic, because of people's safety concerns about being in crowded polling places, this election was going to look different than any other election. Also, I think the stakes of the election, the level of political engagement and projections based on polling about turnout suggest it will also possibly be the highest turnout presidential election ever. I think that's almost certainly going to be the case. Now, the combination of those two things mean that the administration of the election is going to be, in its own way, logistically complicated. You know, there's lots more ballots, mail-in ballots, to process and count than certain states have ever had to process and count before. There's more early voting locations that you might have to staff. There's concerns about having sufficient poll workers on election day, particularly because poll workers tend to be drawn from the over 65 demographic, which is also a group that's sort of most exposed to the highest risk from coronavirus. So there's all those sort of logistical concerns. And then on top of that, you have the president of the United States, you know, very actively waging a rhetorical battle to delegitimize the entire system. I mean, he has, you know, invented stories about widespread mail-in voter fraud. He's threatened an army of poll watchers who his campaign wants to recruit, quote, able-bodied men and women, which is like the language of, you know, militia recruitment. You know, it's unclear to me why, for instance, if you were like in a wheelchair, you couldn't be a poll watcher for the Trump campaign. Like, I don't quite get it. So the threat that's posed by this, there's a bunch of them, right? So there's the fear about this sort of legitimacy, which is a slippery concept, and we'll talk about it a little bit, which the president is very, I think, forthrightly trying to undermine in advance. I don't think there's any question about that. Like, that's what he's doing right now. And then there's a broader question about the legal battle that might be waged post hoc about counting ballots. And there are efforts right now, the Trump campaign, there's 300 lawsuits happening throughout the country around access to polling places and deadlines for ballots and things like that. And then afterwards, we can expect a lot of lawsuits about what ballots gets counted and what gets thrown out. And amidst all that chaos, there's like real disaster scenarios that people have spun out about, you know, state Republican legislators sending their own slate of electors to the Electoral College and missing deadlines as required by statute for when the Electoral College has to convene. I'm putting that in air quotes because they don't actually physically meet. And, you know, all this stuff is confusing and sort of terrifying in its own way and really Byzantine as a kind of legal and technical matter, I have to say, as someone who follows it closely. And the person I feel like who's sort of most read in on this is my guest today. And I would say that he's read in, he's not a practitioner. So someone like Mark Elias, who we've had on the program a lot, is a Democratic Party lawyer and is very read in, but he's actually the one filing the suits in a lot of cases. Edward Foley holds the Ebersole Chair in Constitutional Law at Ohio State University And he heads the university's election law program, and he studies election law. His books include Presidential Elections and Majority Rule, The Rise, Demise, and Potential Restoration of the Jeffersonian Electoral College, and Ballot Battles, The History of Disputed Elections in the United States. And as you can tell from that CV, he's sort of the perfect person to speak to about the situation we find ourselves in. So, Professor Foley, it's great to have you on the show.
Well, it's great to be with you, Chris. Thanks. And Ned, please call me Ned.
Ned, we're gonna start at the most basic, big picture view of this, which is this: American election administration is a hilariously balkanized enterprise. Like, if I say to you, Professor Foley, Ned, who runs elections in America? Like, what is the answer to that simple one sentence question?
Almost 10,000 different jurisdictions, so even more people than that, because it's not just 50 states, it's all the municipalities that actually run the elections. So it is, that's a plus and a minus. I mean, it's obviously makes it more chaotic. It also means it's harder, you know, to hack the entire system, for example, or to control in a partisan way the entire system.
Yeah, that's right. I guess if you were to like try to do something systematically across those 10,000 jurisdictions, whether that's like automatically register everyone, which would be nice, or like nefariously screw with the system, both are kind of hard. So when you talk about these 10,000 different jurisdictions, like just tell me more about that. Like, who are they and what are their jobs and roles?
Yeah, it's probably more like 8,000. But, you know, when you're that high, who's counting exactly? You know, and again, this varies state to state and locality. Some places it's very much bipartisan, meaning you have to have, you know, one Democrat and one almost like a Noah's Ark theory of election administration. Everything has to be in tandem. Sometimes the rules are there are two different keys. You know, this goes back decades. The open, you know, old-fashioned ballot box. The Republican person had a key, and the Democrat had a key, and they opened the box at the same time so that each party looked over each other's shoulders. In other places, it's not that. It's one party rule, and if there isn't sufficient transparency, you know, the locality can kind of run the show in its own particular way. I do think with media being more pervasive in the modern era compared to, say, 50, 60 years ago, you know, it's harder to hide bad action than it used to be. But it's a multi-textured landscape, I think it's fair to say.
So you've got some federal... I mean, obviously, some federal laws apply here. There's federal election law, then there's state election law, and then there's like county administration, right? So, in my case, like the New York City Board of Elections is the body that is sort of like deciding a thing like where my early voting location actually is, right? But it's the state that's going to make rules about like, you know, no excuse absentee balloting. Is that the basic framework for these kind of big policy decisions?
Yes, I would say the state legislature is the primary authority making the rules, especially for the voting process. Like you say, if it's going to be a no excuse absentee ballot or vote by mail, the way, say, Oregon has it or Utah, that's going to be a state legislation decision. But then it's going to get administered at the local level. Now, there are secretaries of states in most states that have are considered the chief elections officer of the state. But the degree of power that that state official has over the localities varies widely. So in some states, the secretary of state can be more directive and insist you follow these administrative rules. So they have to be consistent with state legislation, but any gaps in the state statute can be filled in at the state level by the Secretary of State. In other states, all the Secretary of State can really do is give guidance and cajole and doesn't really have strong administrative power. So you have to take that one state at a time.
So just to kind of put a fine point on this with an example, let's talk about Harris County, right? Because that seems like there's a little bit of a state locality battle happening in Harris County. Harris County is one of the largest, maybe the biggest county in Texas. It includes Houston. It elected a young Latina county official, they call them sheriffs there, named Lena Hidalgo, who's the sort of county administrator for that state, for that county, Harris County. And then, of course, has a Republican governor. And there's been two sort of battles between them, right? So they had a bunch of drop box locations, I think 12 around the county, where voters could drop their mail-in ballots, right? If they didn't trust the mail service and or they wanted to make sure, absolutely sure, it doesn't get lost in the mail. The governor then said, no, every county only can have one location. And then there's also been a fight where Lena Hidalgo wanted to mail out an application for an absentee ballot to every voter, and the state blocked that as well. So that's an example, right, of where you have these kind of competing imperatives between how, say, a local official might want to administer an election and higher authorities might want to.
Yes, exactly right. And for a statewide election, which, funnily enough, we think of the presidential election as nationwide, but of course it's because of the Electoral College system, it's these are like governor's elections in a way, in that it's the entire state voting. There is this equal protection principle that means, you know, so there can be some county by county variation type of voting machines and technology, but some variation among different cities within a state or different localities within a state could raise equal protection problems under the federal constitution, right? In other words, if you want to make sure that every Texas voter has an equal voting opportunity, you at least have to ask the question, is Harris County getting more or less than the rest of Texas? So local variation can sometimes be good and sometimes be bad. And also there's timing on this. Again, there might be an ideal rule that we would like to have in place, but if it's not in place already, changing the rules when you're already in the midst of the election can get really complicated. We saw that in South Carolina, for example, with litigation going on. So there's a lot of moving parts. And then what can get overlaid on that is the partisanship, right? You'd like to think that every official, local or state level, is trying to do this in the genuine sense of the public interest. What's best for voters? What's best for the process? But we have to be realistic about what's
like
going
to
on.
Think that.
You would like to think that.
All right. So you've got multiple levels of administration. You've got multiple jurisdictions. Then you've got partisan battles. And I think, you know, plus, you know, you've got a long history in which these battles go to some of the deepest core battles in the country's development as a democracy, of course. You know, I was watching after John Lewis died, I went back and watched the Eyes on the Prize episode about Selma. And, you know, one of the notable things is that, you know, the thing they start protesting is the local Selma voter registration office, which is only open like 2 hours a day, 3 days a week. And to me, it's such a perfect example because it's like facially race neutral. It's just an administrative decision. Like, when's your office going to be open? Well, just 6 hours a week. But it was driven very obviously by a Jim Crow desire to explicitly disenfranchise Black people. So there's also this like this deep history overlaid all of these fights of what has come before in battles about ballot access.
Oh, absolutely. And I think it's fair to say that we really weren't, as a country, a full democracy in the way we've come to understand it until the Voting Rights Act was adopted in 1965. I mean, for the ballot battles book that you mentioned, you know, I studied some disputed elections in Texas, actually, in the 1940s. And you can't really think of Texas in the 1940s as sort of a functioning democracy by our current modern standards. Sad to say, but that's a true part of our history. And then, of course, if you go back to Reconstruction and the collapse of Reconstruction, you know, we clearly had a collapse of democracy after the failure of Reconstruction.
So let's talk a little more specifically about this election. So that's the sort of broad, right? We've got this, like, we've got the historical story of the country sort of battles between, I mean, ebbs and flows, honestly, of democracy. It's not a forward march, right? We've had more and less democratic moments. We've got the sort of historical reality that battles over seemingly mundane questions of election administration can actually be deep battles about enfranchisement, democracy, and political power. But then we also have the fact that, like, there are a lot of logistical administrative questions being decided by various actors across 8,000 jurisdictions. Sometimes the partisan motivations, sometimes not, sometimes competently, sometimes not, right? So this, like, very complicated framework. And now we throw that whole thing into a once-in-a-century pandemic in which every logistical part of normal life has been disrupted. First, let's talk a little bit about vote by mail. So, you know, what has the history been like for states that already had it well established? And what is happening now in states that want to give people a safer option to vote?
Yeah, so I definitely want to talk about that. But in your question, I think, is premised this analytical distinction that might be useful just to put on the table, which is we've got a logistical challenge this year like no other because of the pandemic. But then, as you've suggested, we have a normative challenge too.
Right, right.
Because of the partisanship and the polarization. And it's the combination of the logistical challenge and the normative challenge that is, you know, making this ever more stressful.
Wait, let me add one more thing to that, because I think this is important. What that makes it more stressful, and there's also a very kind of wicked thing, and I know that you are a studiously nonpartisan individual, and admirably so. So I will just editorialize here, which is that there's a wicked thing in which a person uses invocations of the genuine logistical problems to further their normative project in terms of access, which is to say, oh my goodness, look at this mess. Look at this mess. They screwed this up. They printed out the wrong thing here. They did that. See, can't be sending out these ballots. Now, of course, the conclusion that a person like this, say the president, might, you know, end up with is a normative conclusion. He has a strong view of how the election should be conducted. But the invariable fact of logistical complications, which will happen, provide a pretext for certain, in my view, bad faith normative arguments.
Right. And to put it, this in my vocabulary, it would be to say, for someone who wants the system to work for the sake of the voters as a whole, I think the purpose of an election is so that the voters collectively get their choice. Right. And so we may have a result that, despite the logistical challenges, the system actually works. But because of a public narrative that casts doubt on it,
correct,
people may be confused. And that would be, in some ways, you know, the ultimate tragedy of democracy, that we were able to pull this off in the pandemic,
correct,
and yet we didn't realize that we were, in fact, successful.
That is a great point. So let's talk about those. Let's just talk about the logistical challenges around mail-in voting, and then maybe we can talk about some of the polemical sort of political controversy that has been layered atop that. But logistically, you know, mail-in voting, even universal mail-in voting, is used in a lot of states and has been fairly, as I understand it, a very effective and low, you know, safe and low fraud means of conducting elections. Is that a fair generalization?
Yes. I definitely think that's right with respect to fraud. It's a very low risk of fraud. It's not zero, but it's very low. But the thing that I think we do have to acknowledge is that, despite the convenience of vote by mail and the necessity of it this year in the pandemic, is the error rate that voters innocently suffer as a result of just mistakes. Again, this varies from state to state. It depends in part on the rules, but voters can try to be successful and their ballots can get invalidated if they forgot to sign properly the envelope, or if the post office, you know, delivered it late. That isn't a reason to avoid vote by mail if you need it because of your health conditions. It is a reason to try to vote by mail on the early side of the process, especially this year. But, you know, I think we have to acknowledge that, you know, there's some risk of disenfranchisement, unfortunately, because of clerical mishaps in the vote by mail process.
And also confusion. I mean, I think, like, so there, we've already seen this, like, there's the naked ballot question in Pennsylvania, which you've talked about and we've talked about in the show, where there's two envelopes, one that the ballot goes in and then that envelope itself goes in a bigger envelope so that they can receive the big envelope in the processing center, take out the smaller envelope and record, oh, this person voted, but we don't know who they voted for. Now we're putting in the smaller envelope with a secret ballot in this pile. And if you miss that middle step, then we spoil the ballot and your vote doesn't count, which is a huge risk, right? Like, you don't want tens of thousands of people's votes being thrown out.
Right, right. But, you know, to focus on the Minnesota U.S. Senate seat from 2008, this was Senator Norm Coleman was the incumbent and Al Franken was the challenger. You know, there was litigation over that result because it was close that went for months, and it was all about rejected absentee ballots. There were about 12,000 absentee ballots that were rejected. Al Franken was able to turn the results around in the recount by saying that some of those ballots had been wrongly rejected and deserved to be counted. And then there was an equal protection overlay to that about, well, are the rules being applied the same all around the state of Minnesota? You know, you hope never to have an election caught up in that kind of litigation, but it happens. And so, and it's absentee ballots that can be more vulnerable to that those kind of lawsuits than in-person voting.
So this is a really important point. I want to just like hammer this home. What I'm hearing from you is there are risks with mail-in voting. They are not risks of higher levels of fraud. They're actually risks of higher levels of disenfranchisement. That the real risk that you're kind of onboarding, particularly if you're expanding it among a populace that doesn't normally do it, is that a certain percentage of the ballots don't get counted because people are not used to doing it and they don't necessarily follow all the steps. Or on the clerical side, on the receiving side, there are errors. And when you combine that, some non-trivial amount of error might mean some non-trivial amount of ballots that aren't counted.
Yeah, and no, unfortunately. I mean, you know, a disenfranchisement rate of 1%, that's 1% of all your voters who are I mean, these are eligible voters. These are registered voters. These are people who are entitled to participate. And some states have had disenfranchisement rates higher, you know, 5%, 8%. And wow. So we hope that through public service announcements, whether it's, you know, the particular issue of the so-called naked ballot or what have you, that people vote properly. I mean, I think one message, for the individual voter who is going to vote by mail is take the time. Don't be distracted by, you know, kids before bedtime or TV or, you mean, you really actually need to follow the instructions and do it right because you can get tripped up. And I hope that doesn't happen because I don't want anybody to be disenfranchised.
One logistical benefit is there are a bunch of states that let you track your absentee ballot. Right. So just for this is a little news you can use. But I think that for people that are going to vote absentee by mail, there's a bunch of states. I know North Carolina is one of them, for instance, where you can send it in. And then there's like through the website, you see like, oh, we got it. And it, you know, it all good or no, not all good. Right.
Yes. Right. I mean, it's like a FedEx package. And some states you even get text. You can sign up for text messages for an update on your where your ballot is in the process. And some states, again, allow for cure periods for these clerical errors. So, again, the advantage of doing it on the early side is that if you do run into something like this, you could take advantage of a cure period.
We'll be back after this quick break.
Why are smart businesses graduating to NetSuite by Oracle? Because NetSuite eliminates the expense of multiple business systems by consolidating your operations together into one. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform and one source of truth. NetSuite reduces IT costs because it lives in the cloud with no hardware required, so you can access it from anywhere. You cut the cost and headaches of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified business management suite. Bringing all your major business processes into one platform improves efficiency, slashing manual tasks and errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move, so do the math. You'll see how you'll profit with NetSuite too. And now, by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Just go to netsuite.com/podcast25 for more information. That's netsuite.com/podcast25.
Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. In fact, Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/podcastfree, all lowercase, shopify.com/podcastfree, shopify.com/podcastfree.
Let's talk about some of the litigation there's been over this. I mean, it seems to me that if there's a partisan valence here, it's been fairly clear, which is Democrats have generally been engaged in lawsuits that would expand the number of ballots that are being both sent out to people, like they expand the access to mail-in ballots and expand the universe of countable ballots, which is to say reduce reasons to throw them out. And Republicans generally have been on the other side of that, which is restricting the universe of people voting by mail and increasing the reasons that a ballot might not be counted. Is that a fair characterization of the current, you know, litigation landscape?
I think that's an accurate general picture. I think what it raises the question again: who gets to make the rules? In a democracy, I mean, people might have reasonable differences of opinion about exactly how to run the voting process. For example, I think witness requirements are really silly as a policy for an absentee ballot. And so I wouldn't want a legislature to have that. I think there is a legitimate question whether in the midst of a pandemic, asking somebody to sign, you know, to have a witness is unconstitutional, and that gets us into constitutional standards. So that's sort of one issue that's been litigated. Another issue has been this issue of ballot collection, or Republicans use the term often ballot harvesting. And there, again, there's differences of opinion. And the question is, to what extent does the legislature get to make some policy judgments that you and I might disagree with? Because the litigation is asking to overturn the legislature's decision based on general constitutional principles.
Right. So, and this is where we find ourselves right now with a lot of this litigation. So you have, like, you know, for instance, in Wisconsin on absentee ballots, right? The contention by plaintiffs there, the Democrats who are suing, is that they've essentially created like a system designed to fail, whereby you can request an absentee ballot a few days before the deadline that it has to be in, and then get it and then send it back right away, and it doesn't get there in time, and whoopsie, we don't count. And so, you know, they have successfully litigated, I think, in federal, the jurisdictional question here we can get to in a second, but they've successfully litigated in court in April to count ballots that came in after the deadline, but were, you know, postmarked beforehand. It looks like they had won that from a district court federal judge. And then just today, by a 2-1 decision, a 3-judge panel in the 7th Circuit of Federal Appeals overturned that. And so I guess the question is, like, what are the battling imperatives of the law here? Because it starts to feel extremely partisan to me. Like, one can't help but notice, like, you know, what judges are coming from, what not, you know, presidents have been nominated, and which party controls which Supreme Courts, which are handing down which decisions, which seem to favor one side. In a legal sense, in this Wisconsin question, for instance, as an example, what are the sort of legal equities or legal arguments involved?
Well, it's a really important case and example. I think particularly back in April, when the pandemic had just hit and there was this massive sudden need for vote by mail that the state was definitely not used to. And as you said, there was this inconsistency of the deadlines that just didn't make any sense. There was genuine disenfranchisement of tens of thousands of voters, maybe 14,000 voters, it turned out in the end. And I, you know, my own view of constitutional law is that that was a valid constitutional claim that needed remedy. And I think the court was right to try to find the remedy.
Let me just stop you there. What's the constitutional claim?
I think it's equal protection. It's like the voters, because the voters were obeying the rules. They had applied for a ballot on time. And yet some of the voters who had done everything that they were supposed to do were deprived of a ballot.
Right.
Right. They never got their ballot. So whereas other voters who played by the rules did get a ballot, and an election that's statewide, again, that's the equal protection point. If you lived in one part of Wisconsin, the clerical overload, you know, disenfranchised
right.
you, but in another part of the state,
right.
they were able to keep up. So I thought that was a valid claim that needed a remedy. You know, the argument I think that's made now is that voters, you know, understand the pandemic, and you know, voters have to take some responsibility for the decisions that they make about voting. And so if you're a voter who wants to vote by mail and you wait too long to get your ballot, maybe that's on you as opposed to the government disenfranchising you. I don't know that I agree with that, but the equities, as you say, which are part of the legal analysis, do shift a little bit in terms of the particulars involved.
It just, I have to say, like, my wife, who you know, Kate, would, I think, laugh at this because I tend to be kind of a bit of a legal realist on all these questions. And, you know, she clerked on the Seventh Circuit for Richard Posner, who was sort of famously of that persuasion of analysis, and I've always been sympathetic to his view on a lot of these questions. I mean, it really is hard sometimes, particularly when you look at like the ultimate, you know, the ultimate Supreme Court case on this in my life, Bush v. Gore, to not just really feel like you're watching people reach their conclusion and then backfilling some legal justifications, you know, around it. I mean, Bush v. Gore being the sort of most obvious because the actual constitutional provision they cite, the equal protection, they go out of their way to then say cannot be cited as precedent in future cases, which is to me always kind of a little bit of a tell about the legal analysis of Bush v. Gore. But like, I don't know, I guess how wrong am I to be cynical as a legal, in a kind of legal realist mode that when you're balancing these complicated and difficult high stakes equities, particularly in this kind of uncertain environment, that people sort of judges kind of partisan or ideological affiliations and dispositions are driving a huge amount of it.
Well, I think Bush versus Gore is a special case in this regard for many reasons. But one is the justices looked like they were ruling not in alignment with party against their own philosophy.
Right.
You know, in some of the cases this year where the judges are splitting, you could try to label it as just Republican judges versus Democratic judges. But I think some of these splits could be attributed to genuine philosophical disagreements. You know, part of the problem here is our legacy of voting rights as a matter of constitutional law. You know, we talked before about the Voting Rights Act, which is a federal statute that deserves protection in courts and so forth. But the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment is very general and was, if we're honest about it, was not designed to protect voting rights. How do we know that? Because they needed the 15th Amendment
right.
to follow up on the 14th. So if you are a kind of an original intent judge as a matter of philosophy, you're going to have a narrow view of the Equal Protection Clause and say, don't blame me as a judge, blame the Constitution for not protecting voting
right.
the way you'd
right.
like it to. And so where what we're in addition to all of the issues on the table this year, the logistics of the pandemics and everything else, we're also in the midst of a judicial tectonic plate shift as justices who were more sympathetic to voting rights, constitutional jurisprudence, even Justice Kennedy, who was a Republican appointee and conservative, he was not a diehard original intent judge the way a Justice Gorsuch is. And so the changing composition of the court is actually now causing the court to revisit some basic principles with respect to interpretation in this area. And that may cause some whiplash, unfortunately. I mean, if you sort of go into court with the expectation that the jurisprudence is what it's been for the last decade or more, you know, really going back to the 1960s, one person, one vote, but you've got judges who have a totally different philosophy and don't believe in precedent very much as part of their jurisprudence, we're in for some topsy-turvy in terms of just how the courts handle these cases.
Well, let's talk about, so we've talked about the sort of, so there's there's in-person early voting, and there's absentee voting. There's the expansion of the ability for people to apply for absentee voting. There's a lot of litigation about that, right? There's sort of front-side litigation and then post-election litigation. So we've been talking about sort of front-side litigation, which is all these sort of questions about ahead of time, the administration, who can get ballots, what ballots can and can't be counted. I think the nightmare scenario people have is like, the ballots are being, here's the total nightmare scenario for me is that, like, basically the president declares victory on election night, because of course he's going to do that, that he succeeded in polarizing the question of election day versus mail-in voting sufficiently so that the votes counted on election night of people who voted that day have him winning, and then proceeds a kind of sort of multi-state assault through the courts to prevent election officials from counting outstanding absentee ballots. How plausible is that?
Well, I don't think that will win on the merits, because the courts are going to be courts of law applying rules and will be evidence-based. So I don't think anybody can say, invalidate these ballots because I don't like them, or I think they might be counterfeit from a foreign country. That's just not going to work. Ned, in court.
Okay, let me just slightly push back on that. These are the kinds of conversations we have in my house. Like, there is an ACA case before the Supreme Court that is manifestly ludicrous on its face, that has been laughed at by every single analyst in which they have tried to strike down the ACA based on the zeroing out of the mandate, even though you can't even find a harm. They're going to, and all the severability jurisprudence basically points in one direction. And yet, like, they found a district judge who said, yeah, strike the whole thing down. And in some ways, like, in these high stakes hothouse arenas, like, all you need is one district judge who goes along with your ludicrous argument, and then you've got a controversy.
I mean, yes, there's always the wild card, but I think the likelihood is this type of litigation is going to be in state court, not federal court, for better or worse.
Right.
And it's going to be in the first instance in administrative bodies whose whole job it is to figure out what an honest and accurate count of the voting process is. So when a candidate or campaign says, invalidate these ballots because I don't like them, right, and and they're going to say, well, wait a second, that's not how we do elections.
Right.
The two things that I think are worrisome in this regard is, one, not that these claims will win as such, but that they'll run out the clock, that the litigation will clog up the system to the point that some states, might not be able to finish the whole counting process on time in order to meet the federal deadlines of the Electoral College, which, as you said, isn't one single national meeting, but there are these meetings that take place on a state-by-state basis on December 14, and the Constitution says they have to be the same day all around the country. So that is a kind of hard stop. And, Pennsylvania is the state in particular that I'm, because it took them a long time to count their votes anyway in the June 2nd primary. If you layer on litigation, over these ballots, that just delay is a concern. And to go back to Bush versus Gore, the court was 7-2 on equal protection. It was 5-4. On the remedy, and the reason why that was the split was this so-called safe harbor deadline that is supposed to be the state's decision whether they want to take advantage of this congressional promise that's the so-called safe harbor. And the majority of the U.S. Supreme Court said, well, Florida's told us we want to take advantage of that. And the dissent said, well, but that's Florida's choice, so you've got a remand to let them choose again. And what's the point of all of that? That's to say that deadlines matter. And, so I do think we have to worry about the capacity of litigation to finish up on time.
Wait, I want to just press on this a little bit. Like, is it constitutional deadlines or statutory ones in the Electoral College Act, like that create these deadlines for states to choose their electors?
Congress gets to pick the date, so that's statutory. But the one constitutional rule is that the meeting of the electors themselves has to be the same day all around the country.
Okay.
So Congress could change. It doesn't have to be December 14, but it has to be whatever date in Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, everywhere, and Congress happens to have picked December 14 for that date this year.
So right. So the December 14 is worrisome insofar as if a combination of a logistical backlog with an overwhelmed system dealing with ballots they haven't and a flurry of legislation that delays counts or gums up the works gets you to the point where you don't have a declared winner in a state by December 14th.
Correct. That is worrisome to me. Again, I hope it doesn't happen. It shouldn't happen. It's essentially 6 weeks from November 3rd to Monday, December 14th. But those 6 weeks can go by quickly if you're tied up in lawsuits.
Well, but why would lawsuits prevent you from voting, from counting?
Well, so, you know, some of this gets very, very technical. And if the state law is that you cannot have a final certified result of the statewide popular vote, and pick Pennsylvania's hypothetical here, unless you finished up in every single county, that goes back to the localities. If one locality is slow, either because of logistics or because there's a right to appeal a ruling to a judge who's slow for some reason,
right,
or you have a COVID outbreak in the administrative office or the courthouse that somehow slows things down, there's a danger that you can't have the official certified statewide result if you're missing some ballots. And even if you might, depending on what the state rules are, if you're missing any ballot, if you can't have a final result, then you don't have electors based on your popular vote. That's why I wrote an op-ed for a Pennsylvania newspaper website that said, you know, Pennsylvania is looking at trying to improve a couple of these technical rules so that they can finish counting fast. So-called pre-canvassing, which would be good. And I thought maybe they could borrow from some other states to say, we just got to make sure we meet this Electoral College deadline. And all the local officials and local judges can tell litigants, you know, we need a briefing schedule.
You know,
we've got to do this on time so as not to disenfranchise the entire state.
Just to summarize where we are in this, Ned Foley says, the most brazen sort of strong arm move of don't count these ballots. I don't like them. They come from, you know, areas I don't think are going to go favorably for me is not going to fly. But essentially a flurry of legislation combined with logistical problems that delay a vote and make it hard to get to that deadline to certify is one worry. There was another worry you said that you had.
Yes. So even though these claims don't have merit and I think would be thrown out by judges as not evidence-based and not rule-based, this concern that if there's a public narrative that develops about distrusting the results, and you talked about the fact that, you know, the early count might favor the Republican candidate and then the later count, because of the so-called blue shift, vote by mail favors the Democrat. If there gets to be this narrative that, oh, how can we trust this later count? And that takes hold in the state legislature. The state legislature might try to attempt to use constitutional authority. This would be very contested and would probably also be litigated. But the move that one could imagine would be based on something that was thought of in Florida back in 2000. Didn't happen because Al Gore conceded after the U.S. Supreme Court decision. But the legislature in Florida was saying, wait a second, if this doesn't go the way we want to, we'll just throw the whole thing out and appoint electors directly under Article 2 of the Constitution. So, again, hypothetically, you know, what if the legislature is convinced not to trust the counting process? Again, this would not be evidence-based. The later counted ballots are all valid. They have to be scrutinized through the process. But it's what is the appearance and the rhetoric that might take hold.
And what does the Constitution say about that?
So the Constitution gives state legislatures the authority to choose the manner of appointing electors. Now, they've exercised that choice by giving us the popular vote. And they've done that
so
in
nice
all 50. Yes. They've done it for years and years in all 50 states.
It's so sweet and so gracious and thoughtful. It is crazy that it's like we only have a democracy in the sense of the highest office in the land by the grace and charity of our state legislatures.
Yeah, it is. But that's, unfortunately, you got it. That's the real Achilles heel to the whole system right there.
And but the sort of constitutional question is, like, also that they don't say the states, right? They say the state legislatures.
Correct.
Right. So then there's a sort of interesting question of, like, could the Republicans in Pennsylvania in the two state houses, which they control, like, appoint a Trump slate independent of Governor Tom Wolf, who's a Democrat, and independent of the popular vote?
That's the concern. Again, I think immediately if that was tried, people would protest for lots of reasons, including perhaps the legislature can't act unilaterally without the governor's involvement. I think the lesson of history going back to 1876, which no one taught me 1876 in high school or college, so I had to kind of look it up. But, you know, something like
the famous Hayes-Tilden, in which the popular vote and electoral vote split, and the Hayes wins despite getting fewer popular votes. And the price of it is removing northern troops from their occupation of the South at the time, essentially enforcing democracy, biracial democracy, and in the franchise for Black people.
No, that's exactly right. It really is it's America's tragedy. I mean, you know, the party of Lincoln was the party of the 15th Amendment and voting rights and civil rights and trying to get equality. And their fight to get the White House and have Hayes inaugurated, they won that at the expense of abandoning their commitment to voting rights and civil rights.
So wait, but what happened in 76 in terms of these disputes?
So what happened was that in three southern states and Oregon, there was this contest over the Electoral College, and you had both the Hayes electors and the Tilden electors meeting simultaneously on the appointed day, each claiming a different source of authority in state government and state law as to being the true valid electors. They both can't be right, but it was this conflict, and it goes to Washington and Congress for resolution. And Hayes, for complicated set of procedural reasons, wins all of those battles in the congressional fight and prevails. So if we're trying to imagine what that might look like this time, to your question, you know, say the popular vote in Pennsylvania does get certified in favor of Vice President Biden. So the Biden electors meet in Harrisburg on December 14, vote for Biden, send their submission to Washington. But if the legislature gets hold of this narrative that you can't trust the popular vote, they could purport to appoint the Trump electors as a rival set of electors. Now, that may not be legally appropriate as a matter of state law or federal or whatever, but if they do that and send their piece of paper into Washington with the Trump votes that were also cast on December 14th, then it's up to Congress to choose between the two submissions. And the relevant federal law, it's called the Electoral Count Act, it was adopted after the Hayes-Tilden dispute, says Congress must consider any piece of paper that purports to be electoral votes from a state. So that's what could allow these rival submissions. You know, one is valid, the other one purports to be valid, but Congress has to sort that out.
And when we say Congress, do we mean, what do we mean? Both houses, one house?
It's a complicated procedure. It's the 12th Amendment to the Constitution, which sets up our Electoral College, calls for this joint session of Congress. So it's a little bit like a State of the Union address, if you're trying to picture it, because the Senate and the House meet together in the House's chamber. But the president of the Senate is the presiding officer. That's what the Constitution says. But we also know from another part of the Constitution that that's the incumbent vice president. So on January 6th, when this meeting takes place, it will be the new Congress that's seated on January 3rd, the new Senate, the new House of Representatives. But it'll be Vice President Pence as Senate president, presiding over this joint session. That's all in the Constitution, but that's essentially all the Constitution says, because it simply says that the vice president must open the packages of electoral votes and the vote shall be counted. It's the passive voice in the Constitution. And my English teacher, yes, my sixth grade English teacher said, never use the passive voice if you want to be clear.
That's wild.
And
this is the 12th Amendment?
Correct.
By the way, wait, what's crazy about this is the 12th Amendment only exists because the original design was such an absolute disaster that it almost destroyed the country, you know, two elections in 1800, right?
Yeah, four elections in, but yeah.
Yeah, four elections in 1800. That's the Jefferson Burr race. And that's where...
It's Jefferson really running against Adams.
I say Jefferson Burr because they end up, those are the two people that Congress selects to be president and vice president, right? But that's the Jefferson versus Adams race. And that's the place where this sort of question of like the original design, which is the number one electoral college getter is the president, and number two, the consolation prize gets vice president. So one of the things the 12th Amendment has to clean up is that terrible design, right?
Correct.
What else is the 12th Amendment trying to clean up from that disaster back in 1800?
Well, that problem is that's all they clean up. It's so hard to amend the Constitution, and they realize because you need 2/3 of each house before you send it on to the states for ratification. And so the Jeffersonians who prevailed, Jefferson prevails after that disaster, and it's like, never again, we got to fix the rules before 1804, but they have not a vote to spare in Congress. So they only fix that, and they leave this other vulnerability, which is, Joseph Story, who's a justice on the Supreme Court in the 1830s, writes his commentaries on the Constitution, and he said, hey guys, there's a real problem here. This passive voice is going to be a disaster.
Oh my God.
He sees it all. And then it happens in 1876, but they don't have they think about trying to amend the Constitution after that, but they don't. Instead, they give us this statute called the Electoral Count Act.
Oh.
So we still have the 12th Amendment with its passive voice not telling us anything. And then we have this statute called the Electoral Count Act that is supposed to fill in the gaps. But it's a pretty crazy statute also.
I'm having that feeling you have sometimes when like something breaks in your house, if it's a very old house, and you call a plumber or someone, and then they like take a panel off and they go, oh, whoa, who did this work in here? Who did this here? Oh, this is crazy. You got gas leaking here. You got all kinds of stuff here. This is not safe. Like this is what it sounds like to have you explain to me the plumbing architecture of literally like the most high stakes election that happens in America.
Yes. No, I wish it were not this way, but it is. Now, I think there is a better understanding of this difficult statute. It's complicated. To try to simplify it, and we're talking basically about the situation where these rival submissions come.
You know,
one for Trump, one. If there's just one submission, it's pretty straightforward because Congress can't throw out a single submission unless both chambers of Congress want to throw it out. So that's one way for us to know. If we get to December 14 and each state is only sending one submission of electoral votes, we're probably home free, because it's going to take both chambers of Congress to try to repudiate what a state does. So that's unlikely. But it's when you get these two rival submissions going to Congress. But if both chambers agree on what to do, that bicameral agreement is supposed to control under the statute. So if the United States Senate and the United States House of Representatives both agree on what Pennsylvania is supposed to be, for Biden, let's say, it's not for Trump. If both chambers agree, that should be the answer. It's only when the Senate and the House disagree over competing submissions that it gets dicey.
Okay, but this is, again, we're very far down a hypothetical here that,
right,
inshallah, will not happen. But I guess the question is, The January 6th meeting is of the new Congress, right? So if Democrats won, say, a majority of the Senate and a majority of the House, it would be Mike Pence presiding over a new Democrat majority, say, in both houses. And I think we could imagine how that would go. It would be a real fight if you had a one house in one party's hands and one in the other.
Right. Now, the only qualification I unfortunately need to tell you about this, because it's is, although the statute was written predicated on the assumption that the vice president is not supposed to have any decisive authority, it's It's more like just running the show of saying, this is announcing things. This is what we received from Pennsylvania. Okay, now this is the next step, but not supposed to actually make any decisions. But there is this argument in American history that was a factor in the Hayes-Tilden dispute, that because the 12th Amendment refers to the Senate president as the presiding officer, there's a claim never adjudicated by the Supreme Court, never really prevailing in history, but there is this claim that the vice president gets to make some calls.
Oh, God.
So, I mean, you know, that, again, the statute is designed to prevent that or to stop that because the Congress said it should be Congress's decision. So I think if you're reading the statute properly, you would say if the Senate and the House want an answer, they should get the answer. And they knew about the obvious conflict of interest that a sitting vice president might have as being on a candidate for the very election in consideration. So my instinct is that it would be untenable for the vice president to try to repudiate what both houses of Congress want. But I've got to tell you, that's sort of an asterisk that's out there.
So that's that. We've now gotten down several steps down a kind of real nightmare scenario. I guess let's sort of return. We talked a lot about the law, and there's state law that pertains. Although ultimately, I think you and I mean, my understanding is the way that this procedurally has moved is that everything ends up in federal court. Ultimately, I mean, you're right. I mean, no one, people might, in terms of this litigation that we might imagine. It seems to me the litigation we're having on the front end ultimately all ends up in federal court. Like, for instance, the Pennsylvania Supreme Court issued a ruling on a bunch of different things. It, you know, one side won some stuff on the naked ballots. The other side won some other stuff on deadlines and such. But then that's being appealed to the federal court, right?
Right. Yes. I think certainly if you think about the time period between November 3rd, when we as citizens vote, all the way to January 20th, Inauguration Day. In my mind, I divide that into three segments. The first segment is November 3rd to December 14th, that meeting of the Electoral College. In that first period, I think you're likely to get, if there's litigation, it's likely to end up in federal court, as you say. I think things get more complicated between December 14th and January 6th, on the proposition that once things are in front of Congress, it becomes a so-called political question that is removed from the courts under the political question doctrine. It's kind of like impeachment. The Supreme Court has said they can't touch impeachment because it belongs exclusively to Congress.
Right.
So maybe this 12th Amendment procedure in the Electoral Count Act kind of all belongs to Congress, and the courts say now it's out of our hands.
Right.
Phase three, the most precarious phase, is what if Congress kind of completely breaks down and can't figure out its own statute, its own rules, such that between January 6th and January 20th, we still have two claims to being president-elect. Somebody has to, you can only have one president on January 20th.
Yeah, I think that's probably right. Yeah.
And so you could imagine the court having to come in at the last minute to kind of save the country from the ultimate calamity.
Oh. Not sure how I feel about the 6-3 court doing that. So we've talked a lot about law, and the law gets pretty thorny and technical. And I'm inclined to view it through a kind of power lens. But you have, I think, to me, some soothing faith in sort of merits and arguments and sort of institutional adjudication of actual claims and their propriety, which I hope you are correct about that. I guess a good place to sort of end this conversation, I just feel like, is the rhetoric. I mean, to me, that's what's more unnerving than anything. I mean, I've never in my life, I don't think anyone has ever seen any rhetoric about the legitimacy and integrity of an election coming from the most powerful person in the country ever. Like, it's just completely unprecedented. It's having a public opinion effect. People along sort of polarized lines have, you know, think that the vote's rigged or there's widespread ballot fraud. One of the president's closest and longest time advisors, Roger Stone, who was convicted of several felonies until he was pardon by the president, said on an InfoWars interview that the president should send federal marshals to impound ballots in Clark County, Nevada, because they're so illegitimate, they're so rife with fraud. I mean, what effect does this rhetoric have on the whole system?
Well, that's why I think the normative challenge is greater than the logistical challenge. That's why I think it's important to distinguish between the two. I mean, I think the greater risk to self-government, government of the people, by the people, for the people, is the fact that our politicians, some of them anyway, don't really believe or seem to believe in that notion that it's the elections are to be held for the sake of the voters, right? Democracy belongs to the people as a whole. We don't hold elections for the sake of the politicians, right? The people are supposed to decide. But, you know, I use the analogy of gerrymandering, right? What is wrong about gerrymandering is that it tries to manipulate the electoral process to subvert the voter's choice so right. That the incumbents prevail at the expense of the voters. And although we're not talking about redistricting of what gerrymandering technically is, we're talking about the mindset of gerrymandering or the risk that that mindset could subvert the presidential election process so that the process is manipulated not to subvert what the voters want for the sake of the incumbents right. And the politicians.
Yeah, that's the disaster scenario. That's subversion. And I think impulses towards that direction have been stoked and are getting stronger in ways that I find deeply unnerving. Professor Ed Foley is a constitutional law scholar at Ohio State University. He heads the university's election law program. He is also an NBC and MSNBC contributor for this election season, so you may be hearing from him. Hopefully not a lot, actually. I feel like the more that we're hearing from you, the worse things are going. So I sure as hell hope we don't have we're not doing a special on January 6th with you playing Anchor Buddy about how the hell we're going to resolve this disputed slate of electors. But that was really, really clarifying, Ned. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Once again, my great thanks to Professor Ned Foley for that fantastic, if terrifying disquisition. You can read his books, Presidential Elections and Majority Rule, The Rise, Demise, and Potential Restoration of the Jeffersonian Electoral College, and Ballot Battles, The History of Disputed Elections in the United States, which is timely reading. We always love to hear your feedback. You can tweet us with the hashtag withpod, email withpod@gmail.com. Why Is This Happening is presented by MSNBC and NBC News, produced by the All In team and Kate Shaw, and features music by Eddie Cooper. You can see more of our work, including links to things we mentioned here, by going to nbcnews.com/whyisthishappening.
With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial, and with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown, and through adaptable problem solving, we do just that. Learn more at marines.com.